Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I am going to cover one of the weirdest loopholes that I know of with student loans. It's going to be one that most of you, it's going to be a new kind of loophole to think about. And so stick with me through some of these examples, because I know that this is probably, again, going to be a little strange and a little kind of a weird thing to get used to. But the loophole is called the double debt loophole. Most of today's podcast, we're going to be talking about the double debt loophole explained. The double debt loophole, if you Google that, you're not going to find anything specifically calling out this loophole by name, except on our site. We like to come up with nicknames for loopholes because it's really complicated. Like, if you're trying to name a planet, do you call it the technical name or do you call it some sort of nickname? That's kind of what we get at, what we're trying to do when we name these loopholes. This loophole has been described before. If you look at some other stuff out there on the web, some people have called it the alphabet soup loophole. Sometimes people will talk about it as we've called it the fighting spouses loophole before, but we settled on double debt loophole because you have to have a married couple that both have student loans with the federal government to be able to use it. So this is going to be a fun show. Hopefully you'll kind of get a kick out of this, even if it doesn't apply to you. A lot of times too, especially when clients listen to our show and they hear about a new loophole that we maybe have not called out by name before, just know that in most every case, we've evaluated you for this. There are some clients that probably got plans from us in like 2018 and before that we might not have evaluated this for, because again, this student loan stuff is complicated and we're always learning things. There's just all kinds of new ways to approach student loan debt. I learned something probably at least every week or every other week about student loan rules that I didn't know before. And I do this all the time, full time. So that tells you how complicated this stuff is. So let's just ease in to this double debt loophole and, ask, what is it? So the first criteria for using it is that you need to be married and that you both must have debt. So if you're not legally married and if you're legal spouse does not also have federal student loan debt, and this is a loophole that's not going to apply to you. At a high level, what you're effectively trying to do with the double debt loophole is have one spouse use the pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment plan. So the spouse that uses that plan would want to have more debt. In other words, a high debt-to-income ratio. And then the spouse with the low debt to income ratio, in other words, the spouse that owes a very modest amount of money compared to their incomes, that spouse would want to be using the revised pay-as-you-earn plan or the repay plan. That is at its core what it is. You're doing that while also filing your taxes married filing separately. You might ask, well, what the heck is the point of having one spouse on pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment? And then another spouse on revised pay-as-you-earn and filing your taxes separately. What the heck do you get from that? So we're going to discuss that more in this podcast, so don't you worry. So let's think about the revised pay-as-you-earn plan as to what it is. So the revised pay-as-you-earn always counts your spouse's income no matter what. So if you're single, then if you do the repay plan, then they're going to count your spouse's income regardless of their debt. So if your spouse has zero federal student loan debt, they're still going to count your spouse's income in your monthly payment. However, if you think about the case where your spouse has federal student loans, then what do you do in terms of your repay? Do you have to make 10% of your household income and you have to do that on two separate payments? So effectively, you're doing 20% of your household income. So if you look at some misinformed guest posts out on the internet, that some of them initially thought that. So we've had people that have said that they're saving money by not filing taxes jointly, doing the repay plan. And in a lot of cases, they're not. They're just not informed. Basically, what they do is they calculate when you file jointly for taxes for student loans, they take your total income and calculate one total payment. So you make 50, your spouse makes 50, 100K, let's just real rough math, say that the payment works out to like 700 a month or something like that. Let's say that each of you has 50% of the debt. So then it would be real straightforward. They would split up that repay payment 50-50. So that means each of you would be paying $350 a month. But let's say that one of you owes 90% of the debt and the other owes 10% of the debt. Then you would split up that repay payment, that total marital payment that was calculated off of your total household income. You split it up proportionately based on the percentage of each person's debt that exists. So if you have 90% of the debt, then 90% of that payment on, you know, of the marital payment, $700, 90% of that's $630. So $630 would go to your loans. And then the 10% of that marital payment, 10% of $700 would go to the spouse's loans. That would be $630 to one, $70 to the other. So that proportional nature of student loan payments is really fascinating, and it can be manipulated. And that is kind of what this double debt loophole really, where it comes from. For example, if you have one spouse with 80% of the debt, then 80% of the repay payment goes to that spouse, and 20% of the repay payment goes to the spouse with 20% of the debt. That's an important distinction because your income does not matter in terms of what repay payment is made. So if you make $100,000, your spouse makes $200,000, that doesn't matter in terms of what your individual payments are. That only influences what the total payment is. So in other words, $100K plus $200K is $300. Then they take 10% of that $300K payment, and then that is split up based off of the debt amount that you have, not based off of your incomes. So that's really, really interesting. Now think about what pay-as-you-earn and income-based repayment is. Pay-as-you-earn and income-based repayment allow you to pay jointly if you're filing taxes jointly, or if you file separately, then it only takes into account your income for determining your student loan payment. Now here's where things get super interesting. If you think about what happens with that repay plan, if you have a spouse with a very low debt-to-income ratio, in other words, a really good debt-to-income ratio compared to a spouse with a really high debt-to-income ratio or a bad one, if you have the lower debt-to-income ratio spouse do the repay plan, then that proportional payment happens no matter what plan the spouse is on. So in other words, if you are dealing with a spouse that has a combined payment of, say, $4,000, and the one spouse has 25% of the debt, well, then 25% of that $4,000 repay payment would be $1,000 a month. And then if you filed taxes separately, then the other spouse could be having to pay based off of only their income instead of paying $3,000 a month. And if that person's income is low and the tax penalty for filing separate is low, then that combined payment can result in thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars per year in savings, which is why you would want to pay attention to this at all, because tens of thousands of dollars a year in savings in some cases is what this loophole is capable of, which is really quite amazing. Let's discuss this further. So it's not just people with pay-as-you-earn eligibility that can do this. And in some cases, people who are ineligible for pay-as-you-earn could still utilize this loophole using the income-based repayment plan. So it's really quite interesting. Now, what is the best application of this? I explained that one spouse with the high debt-to-income ratio uses pay or IBR, and then the spouse with the good or low debt-to-income ratio uses the repay plan, and you file taxes married filing separately. So let's get into a practical example so you can really see the benefit in this, because I think that you can't really talk about student loan loopholes without using lots and lots of case studies and examples. Let's look at a case where both people are doing PSLF, Public Service Loan Forgiveness. So we know this plan. If you've listened to this podcast for a long time, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, right? You pay for 10 years based on your income. And then at the end of the 10 years, if you worked for a qualifying not-for-profit or government employer, the loans are forgiven tax-free after 10 years of service. So let's take a look at two physicians. And don't worry, if you're not a high-income, high-debt couple, we're going to cover you too for this podcast. I get a little bit of well-deserved criticism sometimes for only talking about higher debt, higher income cases. So we're going to cover a variety of different kinds of people. But first, we're going to start off with the OBGYN with $400,000 of student loan debt. So we'll assume that she went to some high-cost private medical school. And we'll say this OBGYN with $400,000 of student loan debt is married to a urologist with $100,000 of student loan debt, and both of them are out of training. Let's say they have 5 years of credit to PSLF and 5 years to go. And I think I assumed that they're making around $200 for the OBGYN and $350,000 a year in income for the urologist. So if you do repay for this physician couple, right, their combined income is around $550,000. They have $500,000 in debt. So if you look at this combined repay payment across both of their loans together, their repay payment would be about $4,400 a month. So $4,400 a month. All right. So if they filed taxes separately, then the OBGYN's payment would be based only on her income. So instead of having, so a $400,000 debt and a $100,000 debt, that's 80% of the debt that's owed by the OBGYN, 20% of the debt that's owed by the urologist. So if you have pay as you earn for the person with the $400,000 in debt, the OBGYN, then if you file separately in this case, then the payment for the OBGYN is based off of only the $400,000 debt, well, specifically for the $200,000 income for the $400,000 in debt. So you take the $200,000 and you figure out what the pay as you earn payment would be on a $200,000 income. And so it works out to about $1,400 a month. $1,400 a month so far, that's less than $4,400 a month so far, because we haven't taken into account the urologist payment yet. So what would the payment for the urologist be? We'll take the amount of the debt that this urologist has. Let's say it's 20% of the overall debt of the couple. If you take 20% times the repay payment for the couple, which is $4,400, that works out to roughly $900 a month. So if you're comparing the total cash flow for this couple, you would compare married filing separate with pay plus repay married filing separate. You know, that total plan would result in $1,400 in payments a month for the OBGYN and $900 for the urologist for a total of $2,300 a month. Now, if you compare that total payment of $2,300 a month to $4,400 a month, that is around that's $2,100 cheaper per month, or about $25,000 less money per year than filing taxes jointly. I'm going to repeat that because some of you guys are like, oh my gosh, what the heck is this, right? You're probably falling asleep to this, especially if this doesn't apply to you. You're like, what the heck do I need to learn this? This is nuts. But $25,000 less per year than filing taxes jointly with this double debt loophole. So the double debt loophole, I thought about calling it big debt, little debt, but $100,000 is not exactly little debt. So it's really double debt loophole. It's two people that both have student loans that have different debt to income ratios that are married could potentially benefit from this. Think about the difference in payments, $25,000. That's after taxes. Before taxes, you're talking probably about $40,000 to $50,000 per year in savings. They're making $550,000. So we just saved this person a month of their income with just a student loan plan. So in other words, you could go not get a student loan plan and work an extra month or pick up the equivalent number of extra shifts to hit that level of income, or you could get a student loan plan. So do you see the importance of getting this, especially if you have a large amount of debt, right? Because this is very, very complicated stuff. So let's talk about a couple other situations. Like, for example, what if the urologist and the OBGYN's forgiveness dates didn't line up? So for example, what if the one spouse was supposed to get her loans forgiven with PSLF like 2 years sooner than the other person? Well, when that person's debt is gone, now the repay payment would have to be 100% allocated towards the spouse with the smaller debt. So that's the risk. But is there a solution? The answer is to that, it depends on the individual. So I'm just going to pretend that this urologist never consolidated his student loans. And if you look at the standard 10-year repayment plan, that would be an option available to him. And instead of paying $4,400 on his loans when the OBGYN's loans are forgiven, this person could simply coast on that standard 10-year plan for an extra couple of years and get tens of thousands of forgiven rather than have to make those $4,000 a month payments. So that's an example of another kind of very specific characteristic that this person would need to be aware of. Now, that standard 10-year plan does not exist if you've consolidated your debt. Then you have to, it's ridiculously complicated, but there's the standard repayment plan, which is not the same thing as the standard 10-year plan. And so the real question is whether or not this urologist could use this and then also get a capped payment or not. So that's where it can get kind of complicated. Now, that's a high income scenario. And I promised you a low income scenario, right? And just to keep things more simple and more straightforward, I'm going to continue to pretend that both of these two spouses using this double debt loophole could utilize public service loan forgiveness. I'm assuming both of them could potentially do it. So we'll say we've got two teachers. Let's say that they both earn $40,000 a year. And let's say that one teacher has $50,000 of student loan debt, perhaps because she pursued a master's degree. And then we'll say the other teacher has $10,000 of student loan debt, perhaps because the teacher only pursued an undergraduate degree. We'll call this high debt teacher and low debt teacher. So low debt teacher, $10,000 in debt, high debt teacher, $50,000 in debt. So low debt teacher, $10,000. Let's say that this teacher might consider the teacher loan forgiveness program, which, you know, would make sense because it's named for teachers. Like if you're a teacher and you're like, I want loan forgiveness, what are you probably going to Google search? Get me teacher loan forgiveness, right? But the problem with this is, let's say that they're both highly qualified teachers, but they're not in math, science, or special education. So instead of the maximum for teacher loan forgiveness, which is $17,500, we're going to assume that they only get $5,000, which is the maximum without teacher loan forgiveness. So let's say that the higher debt teacher thinks that she should probably pursue PSLF, and the lower debt teacher thinks, I could just pursue the teacher loan forgiveness and get $5,000 of my $10,000 forgiven, and I'll pay the rest off. If they get no plan at all, they're going to default into the repay plan, the revised pay-as-you-earn, most likely. Now, it gets complicated. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here. The one teacher with the lower debt might get put into a forbearance, so it can get kind of messy, but let's just say that they both did the repay plan. If they did that plan, that'd be around $350 a month for their total payment, because $40,000 in incomes each, two kids, you do the deduction math, that kind of is what it works out to. So $350 a month, that would be split proportionately based off of their debt. So 80% would go towards the person with the, or actually a little more than that, because I've said the person has $50,000 in debt. So 80, 85%, something like that, would go towards that person's debt. The rest would go to the low person's debt. Here's the issue, though. If they filed taxes married to filing separately, what would that do to the payments? So high debt teacher who has $50,000 in student loan debt would only pay $11 a month under the pay plan. Why is that? First off, when a lot of times people will file separately and they'll ask me, well, who should claim the kids on the tax return? That's actually not relevant. The income certification doesn't ask how many dependents did you claim. It asks what your family size is. That's not the same thing. They're not asking the same thing. So in other words, technically, when you file taxes separately, basically both people get to list the entire family size, and it can kind of actually even result in a little bit lower of a payment. We want people's student loan plans to be as simple as possible. And if there's not a massive savings, we're not going to complicate things because we think that that would hurt you more than it's going to help you. But it's just something to know that you get even bigger deductions than people think you do when you're calculating your payment. So the teacher with the $50,000 in debt filing separately only has to pay $11 a month because they're basically looking at her $40,000 income and giving her a deduction probably of around $35,000 or something like that. Maybe a little more than that even. And they're taking 10%, dividing by 12, and that's what it kind of works out to. Now, the one with the $10,000 in debt pays a proportional payment if they're on the repay plan. So if you take that, you know, proportional amount of debt that this person owes times that $350 joint household payment, that works out to about $57 a month. So if we add those two together, let's just say it's roughly $70 a month. Think about this difference for this teacher couple. You could do this double debt loophole and pay $70 a month, or you could file your taxes jointly and both do repay. Like the loan servicer reps will always tell you is the best plan no matter what. And if you do that, you'll pay $350 a month. So the difference between the double debt loophole fully optimized with everything accounted for, the difference between those two is you're saving about $3,000 per year. Again, that's after taxes. So before taxes, you're probably looking at probably relatively low tax bracket, maybe $4,000 a year. So $4,000 or so, that's maybe the equivalent of, again, a little bit over 1 month worth of salary for one of these teachers. That's a big deal, especially when you're making $40,000 a year. That is a really, really awesome benefit. So we've kind of looked at two examples. One is for a couple that has modest sized debt that would save about $3,000 a year. And the other one was for a couple that has very large sized debt that could save $25,000 per year. Both of those savings are really, really large. Now, the one thing that I did not mention was the penalty for filing taxes separately. So this penalty can in some cases be rather large, especially if your incomes are very, very different. So in this particular case, the teachers would only lose, they would lose the student loan interest deduction. So they make a low enough income that they would get a pretty decent deduction from that. So that works out to about a loss of about $500 from filing taxes separately. So again, that's really not that big of a difference compared to the $3,000 per year in savings. So if you look at the savings from the optimized student loan strategy and offset that against the higher tax costs, then that's a difference of around $2,500 a year in less payments towards student loans. So that's per year. If you kind of spread that out over 10 years or 5 years or however much longer they have to go on PSLF, even this teacher with a modest $60,000 of total student loan debt would be kind of saving, if we assume maybe like only 4 years worth of savings, four times 2,500 is 10 grand, 10 grand divided by an average student loan plan cost of $500. That's getting about 20x the savings compared to what they spend on getting a student loan plan, besides just getting a review of everything and feeling better about their financial futures. So, I mean, if one of these loopholes applies, it very quickly pays for the consult by multiples. Let's look at a couple different examples. So far, I've only used public service loan forgiveness cases. So certainly, if you have PSLF and you're either both pursuing it or one spouse is pursuing it and you both have debt and that debt is significant, this is really important to get this reviewed. And again, most of our clients that we had in 2013, we were aware of this loophole. For some of the clients 2018 and before, we hadn't yet realized this loophole existed. More on that in a bit. The crazy thing is, if this couple had pursued the low-income couple with a couple teachers, if they'd pursued teacher loan forgiveness, then they wouldn't have gotten PSLF on the $10,000 debt at all. They would have gotten the most of the repay payment, the $350 a month, probably would have been applied to the person going for PSLF, and the person would have created an additional $5,000 they had to pay off because the teacher loan forgiveness cap of $5,000 for people outside of certain areas would really not cover most of the debt or wouldn't cover all of it. That's a big deal. You're talking total tens of thousands of dollars of lost money in that case if it wasn't optimized. You know, what about some non-PSLF cases? Or one, let's say we're one person is PSLF and one is not. Let's say we have two pharmacists. One's got $300,000 in debt. One's got $100,000 in debt. Both make about, let's say, $100,000 each, and they have a couple kids. So the repay payment overall, if you're doing filing joint, would be about $1,300 a month. So that's $200,000 in incomes minus the deduction for their family size times 1.5 is the technical formula. I don't want to get into too much of that, but just take my word for it that it's about $1,300 a month if they file jointly with this $400,000 debt, $200,000 income, pharmacist couple, total household income. So if the person with the large debt to income ratio filed separately and chose the pay as you earn plan, then the payment for that person would be about $500 a month. Now, the person going for doing repay on the other debt with a lower debt to income ratio, if you take the proportional payment, right, 25% of the total payment of $1,300, it works out to roughly like $300 a month. So if you sum the pay married filing separate plus repay married filing separate with repay of filing joint for both, the total cost is $800 for the double debt loophole or $1,300 for filing jointly. That's a $500 a month advantage. But what happens if one spouse gets PSLF and one does not? So you could have the one not doing PSLF continue to file separately. So after PSLF happens for the high debt person, let's say, the other person could switch repayment plans. He or she could switch from repay to pay, at least under current rules. So why would you do this? if you have $100,000 in student loan debt and you're paying $300 or so, that debt's going to continue to grow. After 10 years, let's say it's 120, 130K, something like that. I haven't actually looked at that math, but I'm just guessing off the top of my head. Then this person switches from, because if they did repay, they'd have to pay $1,300 on their loans and their loans would get paid off in full. So instead of doing repay, if they switch to pay as you earn, under today's regulations, the repay and the pay plans count for one another. So they could switch over to from repay to pay. Now, the thing is there's no guarantee that that could happen. But I'm just saying under current regulations, you could switch from repay to pay, continue filing separately and paying about $500 a month on the student loan balance and still get that $100K forgiven as well after 10 additional years of payments. Now, what is the risk? So the risk is that they could block this loophole at some point. They could prevent plan switching. They could lock you into your current plan. They could decide that each plan does not count for one another, changing the rules. A lot could happen in the future. I can't guarantee that certain things with student loan policy will not happen. I'm sorry, I am not able to prevent Congress from taking certain actions, right? But what we can do is try to predict what Congress is going to do and try to account for that in the overall plan that you're doing. So the worst case scenario, if you can't get the smaller debt forgiven, is that interest accrues and does not compound. So the worst case scenario is if you took some of this extra money and you put it into investing and in retirement, then you will have enough money to write a check. That would be the goal because, again, this interest is not compounding. It's going to grow at a simple rate of interest. And if you cannot beat a simple rate of accruing interest, then that's not good. That doesn't bode well for your long-term future financially, if you have not saved more than the amount that you need to pay the loan off. After one spouse gets PSLF and one does not, you really want to make sure you have enough to pay the loan off in full, even if you decide rationally that it doesn't make sense to do that. Now, what happens if there's two cases where neither person is doing public service loan forgiveness? Again, I want to tell you the same principle that I tell all of our consultants. Do not go out of your way to make things complicated. If you go out of your way to make things complicated, that is a mistake. That is not the smart thing to do. You will hurt yourself if you go out of your way to make things complicated if you don't have a clear reason why, right? Because otherwise you're just going to do stuff and forget why you did it. It's just going to be stressful. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to create any anxiety with your student loan plan because you want it to be beautiful and easy to manage and easy to understand. But I don't know who said it, I forget, but things should be as simple as possible, but no simpler, right? Maybe Einstein said that or somebody like that. So let's kind of take that example of the two pharmacists and kind of amend it. So let's say that one of those pharmacists, let's say $300,000 debt, $100,000 debt. So $400K in debt as a couple and both earn $100,000 a year. You can look at the scenario and say, well, what if they were pursuing taxable forgiveness instead, right? So in other words, what if they're pursuing the 20-year version of forgiveness because they both worked at a private employer instead of at a not-for-profit or government employer? What I would ask this person, this couple, actually, is I would say, well, what is important to you? Do you want to get low payments? Do you want to have it be simple? We can get your payment pretty low by having both spouses maximize their 401ks. We can get that payment really quite low. And then that's something that maybe lessens the stress of having to figure out some complicated loophole. But let's think about this. Pay as you earn is a 20-year plan, and revised pay as you earn is a 25-year plan. In that case, the pay as you earn spouse would be forgiven first if they both started at the same time, and the repay spouse would have an extra 5 years to go. You can ameliorate that or reduce the risk of that by just simply focusing on the person with the high debt and then setting it up so that worst case scenario, the person with the lower debt, you have enough money to just pay it all off as a lump sum, right? Because a lot could happen between now and forgiveness that could make paying back your student loans much less intense and much less painful than it is currently. And keeping your loans on the federal system, if you keep your loan payments low while you focus on retirement and investment contributions and becoming a practice owner and buying a business and developing that business and those kind of things, that's more important, having a high savings rate than worrying about your student loan payments, as long as it's very clear that you shouldn't just refinance them and pay them back because there's no way to kind of keep the payments low enough to get any forgiveness anyway. The worst case scenario is that the spouse with the lower debt to income ratio, the better debt to income ratio, gets stuck on the repay plan. So for example, let's say that you're doing this pay filing separate, repay filing separate loophole together as a couple, and then you file taxes separately and the first person's loans forgiven. And then now this repay plan, let's say you're not able to get out of it on to pay yourself. Well, then that repay plan would cause you to pay the entire marital payment on your loans alone when the first spouse's loan's forgiven. So that could or could not be a problem because maybe that results in the full payoff of your loans. If it does, that's not the end of the world. You can always decide to just pay a lump sum at the end of the 20-something years when the first spouse's loan is forgiven. And if you're doing that for the spouse with the worst debt-to-income ratio, then that's probably something that works out. So if you have a small amount of debt, relatively small amount of debt to deal with in that case, you want to have a huge taxable brokerage account that's sitting in massive six-figure, seven-figure amounts of mutual funds that you could simply pull out and use to pay off your debt in full. That would be the goal that you would want to do, is to be able to have so much in assets that you could easily afford to pay off the debt. And then the decision of whether or not you pay that debt off in the future is solely based off of what makes rational sense based off the rules that exist at that time. So let me give you an example from my personal life. I, for fate or irony's sake, or just for a good laugh or something, I guess I am now a subject to loan forgiveness with the federal government, simply because I'm a small business owner. So you might have heard of this Paycheck Protection Program. We've certainly mentioned it on the podcast a couple times. It's meant for business owners who have payroll that was impacted by the coronavirus recession. Certainly, we were impacted with the federal government suspending student loan interest. The only people refinancing on our site right now are people refinancing private student loans, which is fine, but it's a huge revenue loss for us. So we qualified for that and we applied. And the thing is there's all kinds of question marks as to whether or not this money is eligible for forgiveness for various different reasons. People are worried about maintaining the same number of people on your payroll. They're worried about proving that they had a certain amount of payroll. They're worried about actually having to pay the funds back instead of being able to have it forgiven. There's just all kinds of worries or stresses around this program. And so what I say to that is the loan interest rate's 1%. I have the funds to pay it out of my net worth fairly easily, luckily. And since my net worth is much greater than the amount that I borrowed, I'm not worried about it because I'm either going to pay back the debt with a 1% interest rate, which is really low. If it was higher, I would still take this bet because it's basically like worst case, it's like a 50-50 bet. I'm not going to have to pay that back, right? If there's a 50-50 bet, I won't have to pay it back. That's much. I don't care what the interest rate is if it's not 50%. Do you see what I mean? So that's kind of what I'm saying about this double debt loophole. If it doesn't work out, well, you just might be stuck either having to file jointly and having to pay a higher amount of money that you would have had to pay anyway, or you'll have one spouse forgiven before the other. And then the other spouse with a smaller debt, you might have to just pay it off as a lump sum or just stretch it out a little bit more. But either way, you would have wanted to have used this loophole to be able to save a lot of extra money into mutual funds, retirement, et cetera. There's a lot to this double debt loophole. If you have never gotten a student loan plan from us, just know that our student loan calculator now that we use in our consults has the capability of analyzing this. The free version that we give away on the website does not. Partly that's intentionally, we don't want to confuse people. Partly it's because we want to keep our best stuff for our clients that pay us for analysis, right? Because it takes time and energy and a lot of effort to create this stuff for you guys. So if you're interested in getting that analyzed, you just need to go to studentloanplanner.com/help and book a time with one of our team members. And again, who should do this? Who should see if they qualify for the double debt loophole? It's people that are married that have very different debt to income ratios. So one spouse owes four times as much as their income, another spouse owes one times as much as their income, and both spouses owe significant amounts of student debt. So that's somebody who needs to get this evaluated. And if you're an already existing client, that you can get this evaluated as well. You'll just need to book a follow-up consult. So just reach out to the consultant that you worked with originally when you created your plan and set up a follow-up consult with them to just get this reevaluated if you want to get it reevaluated. Now, there's another couple of announcements that I've got for you that are a little unrelated to the double debt loophole. The first is that interest rates are going to be, if you haven't heard already, interest rates are going to be at record lows for people who are students for the fall of 2020 and spring of 2021. So if you are a dental student, a med student, law student, know someone that is, any other student of any kind, you're going to be benefiting from these record low interest rates for federal student loans. So the way that they set this is they look at the 10-year treasury auction yield, which is the government borrows, the government asks investors what they want to pay, and the government sets the yield for the particular bond they're selling. So that happened a couple weeks ago. The rate was 0.7%. So you add on to that extra yield for different kinds of programs the federal government offers, and that tells you what the rates are going to be for the future. So that's how I knew all this stuff. So the rates for undergrads for the fall are going to be 2.75%. That's great. That's the lowest in history for undergraduate student loan borrowing. 2.75%. Hot dog. That is really low. That is great news. For people that are in graduate school or undergrads that are needing to borrow extra money, the Stafford unsubsidized interest rate is going to be 4.3%. So, I mean, honestly, that's really low. That's like an exceptional refinancing deal that you're getting, but on a federal student loan instead of a private student loan. So basically, instead of just physicians getting that kind of a rate that are committing to giving away all the government protections, now everybody's getting that rate, regardless of your credit history, if you're a student next year. Now, the last kind of loan that's out there is the Parent Plus and Grad Plus loan. So that's for parents that are taking out extra money for their, you know, undergraduate education of their children, or graduate students taking out more than about $20,000 or $40,000 if you're a medical student or dental student, taking out a lot of extra funds for grad school. And that rate is going to be 5.3%. Those used to be 7% last year. So the federal student loan interest rates have fallen by about 1.7% for the coming school year. So that's great news. It's going to give people interest relief for the coming year. So if you are a student for the coming year, I guess kind of congrats, because those are not like ultra, ultra low, but they're very, very low historically. It's the lowest rates have been in at least 15 years. So that's good news. As good as those low rates are, actually, if you think about it, these interest rates for a lot of people actually don't really matter that much. And the reason is because of loopholes like the double debt loophole that are so complicated to understand that you almost have to sit down and drink like, a Manhattan to try to get through the podcast episode to understand all the stuff, because it's just really weird. So this double debt loophole is, I mean, it's something that I'm excited to continue to evaluate, but that's just one loophole. There's a lot of them out there that our team evaluates when we do student loan plans. I'll give you some more examples. We've talked about these in other podcast episodes. So if you want to learn more about these, just go into our studentloanplanner.com/blog, and there's a little magnifying glass icon. And if you press that icon, it'll allow you to type in something to search. And what you will probably find is podcast episodes on each one of these loopholes that I'll just very briefly mention. There's 8 of them. I'm just going to give you other loophole examples that we look at. There's the double consolidation loophole. That's for parents in particular. There's the standard cap loophole for people that are making quote unquote too much money. You can actually get your payment capped. There's married filing separately, where you can avoid counting your spouse's income if the penalty is low enough. There's the breadwinner loophole, which is for people that live in the 9 community property states around the country. There's the reverse breadwinner loophole for people who are making less than their spouse that also live in one of those 9 community property states. There's the refinancing ladder loophole for people that are trying to pay back their loans who also don't want to screw over their chances of buying a house or a business. There's the die with your debt loophole for the 60 and up crowd out there. I don't want to discriminate, and I don't want to suggest anything too morose there, but it can be a very rational thing to, if you're starting off with no credit in your 60s, to have that loan go into your mid 80s and then consolidate it again so that it can go into your, you know, mid 110s or so. And if you make it that long, then I think that you'll be somebody would probably pay off your student loan debt just because of that headline would be so amazing, right? 110-year-old still owes money on their student loans. I mean, holy cow, I guess that's coming. That'll be a weird day. And then the AIDS loophole is the eligibility loophole, where you can add in a bunch of weird non-qualified kinds of federal loans from different agencies, different departments, like Department of Health. They have a health profession student loan program. You can consolidate those to make them eligible for loan forgiveness. And a lot of people don't know that. That's just like 8 that I named off the top of my head. There's a lot more than that. And this shows you, I guess, why student loans are a lot more complicated than you think. Even if you have done a lot of research on this, you haven't done as much research as we have. And that's not to say that you're not extremely intelligent. You are. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this scenario where you have a lot of debt and a lot of education that you financed using that debt. But the thing is just, it can make your head spin sometimes keeping track of all these loopholes. And we don't charge a used car worth of money for our advice. We charge like a really solid like Xbox or something. I don't know. I mean, what's something that's like a few hundred dollars that's like you would buy without too much thought? The thing is your Xbox is going to give you some entertainment, but it's not going to save you tens of thousands of dollars, I guess, unless you're like some professional gamer. And some of these loopholes can really save you thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars a year. And even if it ends up not applying to you, at least the uncertainty and the anxiety of, am I missing something, is off the table, and you've got a clear plan that's been reviewed by a team that's reviewed almost $1 billion in student loan debt now, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. So anyhow, if you have more debt, more student loan debt than you do income for your household, you really need to review your situation. Even if you think you know what you're going to do, you really need to get it reviewed. If you're an existing client, the goal is to get you to a place where you don't need our services. That's not my goal, to sign you up for a recurring fee service. My goal is to get you a plan and have you really be able to sort of just self-provision the rest of the way. But if you do need us because we discover a new loophole or legislation changes or something in your life changes, we're also available for clients for a slightly lower fee than the initial fee that we have, if you need a double check about whether or not you're still doing things the right way. So thanks for entertaining this episode. I know it's kind of a weird one. I know that it's kind of very counterintuitive to anything that you've probably thought about student loans, because I mean, when I heard it the first time, it blew my mind. I'm like, oh my gosh, man, this just really shows you how complicated this stuff is. So maybe federal student loan legislation will come through and just make all this stuff super easy and really kind of a no-brainer to understand. But then again, that was what the Republican tax bill was supposed to do. And the previous episode last week, we had Tom Bowden on from Buckingham Wealth Management, and he discussed this qualified business income deduction that can give you a 20% write-off for pass-through income. And so the fact that that sounds like some sort of undiscovered language from the Mesopotamian Bronze Age, nobody's ever heard of before, right? It sounded like French, right? I don't know. The fact is like the more the federal government tries to make things less complicated, it seems like it ends up just being really complicated, because all of the special interests sort of claw their hands into it and try to get certain carve-outs made and certain ones don't get made. And then you have to get something that's going to pass the Senate, which is subject to filibuster. So you have to compromise with the other party, right? So it ends up being a mess. So I will say, from a self-interested perspective and from an intellectual perspective, these loopholes are really fun to try to figure out for you, because one, they can save you a lot of money, and two, nobody's thinking about this stuff, or at least very, very few people out there are thinking about all these applications of these complex rules like we are. So thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for encountering yet another weird, fun, crazy loophole that you can tell your friends and impress your friends about at the next cocktail party, which I have no idea when that'll happen because of coronavirus. But hey, we can dream, right? Hopefully one of those happens sooner rather than later. So have a great week. And if you want to ask a question for our show, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We'd love to get some more questions for the podcast to cover, especially about this double debt loophole or any other kind of loophole you want us to explain more. So thank you again, and just stay safe out there.